Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, January 16th, 2021. Section A. API Energy will lead nation's economic revival. Association looks forward to working with new Biden administration on common concerns. By Mel McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. As the U.S. economy works to recover from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, energy industry supporters expect the industry will lead the way. Oil and natural gas are supporting the nation's recovery from the pandemic, Mike Summers, President and Chief Executive Officer of the American Petroleum Institute, stated during his State of American Energy address this week. Summers pointed to the industry's efforts as the pandemic took hold, providing the building blocks for personal protective equipment like gloves, gowns, and face shields, retooling their plants to manufacture that equipment and medical-grade hand sanitizer, providing the power for hospitals, fueling emergency vehicles, and the vehicles that delivered food, essential goods, and now the COVID-19 vaccine. Summers challenged the myth that developing energy prohibits environmental progress, something he said is a false choice. Both developing energy and reducing emissions are essential to advancing society and protecting the environment. Without energy and environmental progress, we risk national security, quality of life, and the American experiment, he said. Because reliable energy is central and consequential to everything else in the economy, we don't get caught up in every political battle of the moment. We keep the focus on the essential work America depends on, producing and delivering American energy, contributing to Americans' national security, answering climate challenges with action and American ingenuity, and keeping energy affordable for all. As Joe Biden prepares to take office as president next week, Summers said he will become president at a time of energy abundance. Speaking on a media call after his address, he said he looked forward to working with the new administration. Biden's key advantage is he's coming on the stage from a position of strength in terms of energy. We've been blessed with energy abundance. That's very different from 2005. He doesn't have to worry about energy supplies or affordable supplies. Summers added that he believes Americans understood the importance of energy and in the November election chose pro-energy senators and representatives from both parties. We want to work with the Biden administration on policies that further emissions reductions that are consistent with the Clean Air Act. There are areas where the industry and new administration can find common ground, Summers said, citing methane emissions reduction and trade as two. He noted the industry's efforts to reduce emissions forming several coalitions like API's Environmental Partnership and the Texas Methane and Flaring Coalition, and investing in technology to monitor and capture emissions. It's in our economic interest to contain emissions because that is a product we sell, he said. We know the administration will want to further regulate methane, and we want at the table to work with them to get the right regulations. It's part of our social license to operate that we have to deal with both in the U.S. and abroad. As to trade, he said opening new markets to U.S. energy like crude, liquefied natural gas, and petroleum products would not only export those commodities, but further the nation's environmental progress. If we're able to open overseas markets to U.S. LNG, we're able to export our environmental progress to areas like China to replace its coal plants. He acknowledged concern about possibility the new administration would ban hydraulic fracturing or even drilling on federal lands, noting that 25% of the nation's production comes from federal lands. New Mexico alone derives 40% of its revenues from oil and gas activity on federal lands. We hope he will change his position on the disastrous plan that would be devastating not just to the industry but to consumers who benefit so much from development on federal lands and waters. Lawyers discuss charges against Cud, Rosa, and Capital Mob by Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE at MRT.com. After two Midlanders were charged Wednesday for their involvement in riots at the U.S. Capitol, law experts discussed how the case may move forward and the possibility of additional conspiracy charges. Jenny Cud, a floral shop owner, and Ilial Rosa, an asylee from Brazil, were charged with two misdemeanors for their roles in riots that broke out on Capitol Hill on January 6th. They each face up to a year and a half in prison for allegedly entering and remaining on restricted grounds and disorderly conduct or violent entry. A criminal complaint and probable cause affidavit show the FBI's case against them is based on security footage inside the Capitol building and their own social media posts. Cud posted on social media during and after the riots, describing their participation, and security cameras captured them walking inside the Capitol's rotunda and nearby areas for about 20 minutes. But even with video evidence, the prosecution must prove Cud and Rosa knowingly entered a restricted area and intended to disrupt the legislative session, according to Amber Baylor, associate law professor and criminal defense clinic director at Texas A&M University. One reason for initially charging these misdemeanors is that perhaps news interviews and the Facebook recordings led to some of those elements in a way that makes prosecution feel comfortable in charging, she said. The FBI's affidavit references a Facebook video in which Cud said, "Hell yes, I am proud of my actions," as well as her statement that she would do it again in an interview with television station KOSA. Cud has denied she was among the rioters who broke through barricades at the Capitol building and assaulted police officers to gain entrance, saying in news interviews that she walked through an open door with several hundred people. "I'm sure her defense will change," said Patrick Metz, director of the criminal defense clinics at Texas Tech University. He added that her lawyers will likely shape the narrative after reviewing the FBI's evidence and would probably encourage her to remember the Fifth Amendment or the right to remain silent. "She should probably stop talking instead of trying to win the battle of public opinion," Metz said. "It's not going to work out for her." One of Cud's lawyers, San Antonio-based attorney Dan Flannery, told the Reporter-Telegram she intended to plead not guilty at a hearing next week. Entering a not guilty plea wouldn't close the door for future plea deals, according to Baylor. If Cud and Rosa opt not to negotiate deals with the prosecution, Baylor said their defense teams would likely attempt to undermine the prosecution's case by arguing they were unaware they entered restricted grounds or that the statutes they've been charged under are too vague to apply. Metz said some rioters may argue that President Trump gave them permission to enter the Capitol building when he told them to march there during the speech shortly before the violence began. However, if the U.S. Attorney's Office adds conspiracy charges to the mix, as some legal analysts have theorized, any defense would become considerably more complicated. If the prosecution can develop conspiracy charges, they will develop those, he said. "I can tell from news reports that they believe there were conspiracies. Individuals who were involved in a crime, like trespassing, can be convicted of more serious charges committed by others in the group if prosecutors can prove those individuals conspired in the initial crime." In this case, the prosecution would need to prove the rioters planned to enter the Capitol and disrupt the legislative session, and that the subsequent violence, vandalism, and alleged murder of a Capitol police officer was also planned or could have been reasonably expected. She noted that some Black Lives Matter protesters and others who protested George Floyd's death were charged with gang activity when violence or vandalism occurred at those protests. The consequences are really striking in contrast when comparing charges against those who protested police brutality and rioters who stormed the Capitol building. The charges against Cudd and Rosa could easily be the same as for a mischievous tourist. Disorderly conduct is a very commonly applied misdemeanor. It can be applied for things as insignificant as being very noisy, using profanity, being obnoxious, and being drunk in public. Metz said it's not uncommon for the prosecution to develop evidence later and file additional charges. He said Cudd and Rosa are low-hanging fruit compared to those being investigated for the death of Officer Brian Sicknick. Investigations for conspiracy also take longer to make headway. As the investigators put it all together, if there were some kind of conspiracy here, it will emerge. A second hearing for Cudd and Rosa, at which time they will enter their pleas, is scheduled for 1 p.m. January 21st in front of U.S. Magistrate Judge G. Michael Harvey in D.C. That hearing will be held virtually. A commentary by Rick Davis, Midland ISD Board President. It's easy to be excited about MISD's superintendent pick. We are very excited to name Angelica Ramsey as our lone finalist to become the next superintendent of MISD schools. She has a proven record of improving academic outcomes, and we are grateful that she is willing to come back to Texas to make transformative academic improvements at MISD. Dr. Ramsey currently serves as the superintendent of schools at Pleasant Valley School District in Camarillo, California, a diverse minority-majority district with a student enrollment approximately 6,500 since 2016. Under her leadership the last 4 years, students' state assessment scores for English language arts and math now consistently outperform the county and state. Prior to serving as superintendent, she served 4 years as chief academic officer and then associate superintendent of the Santa Clara County Office of Education, serving approximately 276,000 students in some 31 school districts. During her tenure, her office received 4 state awards for their collaborative program in visual and performing arts. A comprehensive English learner professional development series, their curriculum leadership council, and their STEAM program that helped increase 21st century teaching and learning. In becoming MISD superintendent, Ramsey will be returning to Texas, where she began her teaching career as a teacher and coordinator for Fine Arts Academy in the Socorro Independent School District in El Paso. As Socorro, she also served as assistant principal at Socorro High School, during which time the school obtained recognized and then exemplary status under Texas then accountability ratings. Her success led her to be tapped to open and become the first principal at Eastlake High School in Socorro. In her inaugural year, Eastlake students, who served a student population of 73% economically disadvantaged and 23% English learners, became the only high school in the district to obtain recognized status. Under her leadership, Eastlake also became the first high school in the region to offer Mandarin classes, implement blended learning, a one-to-one technology program, and be certified in both engineering and biomedical sciences with project Lead the Way pathways. In addition to impressing us during our interviews with her, we were also impressed with what others who have worked with her had to say about her. For example, one of her current board members, Bob Rust, informed us that when she began as their superintendent at Pleasant Valley School District 4 years ago, she inherited a district that was a mess of distrust and unrest. But with her fresh eyes, keen intellect bordering on brilliance, and a very determined work ethic, she righted the district through sheer willpower and an undying work ethic. Rust explained that she learned their district through a multi-month listening tour, then went right to work. She described her as a data-driven, fierce, fair, and fearless administrator who moved quickly to pick her own team, pushed aside dangling debris left over from the previous administration, and eliminated a 30-year tradition of "because we've always done it that way" that was wasting very scarce resources. We are excited that by beginning next month, she will be afforded the opportunity to do that this spring in MISD in preparation for next school year. Ramsey also received high praise from the president of the local teachers union, Scott Wright, who acknowledged that although it was highly unusual for a superintendent and a union president to have a collegial relationship, he had one with Ramsey because from the moment he first met her, he was instantly struck about how genuinely she cared about improving our district. He confirmed that she inherited a difficult situation as teacher morale was at an all-time low and there were staffing problems in the district office. He reported that in response, Ramsey committed herself to improving both issues and did so quickly and efficiently. He explained that she understands how vital each employee is bringing together stakeholders to achieve a pleasant working environment for employees and attaining educational goals for students. Wright also noted that Dr. Ramsey does her homework, comes to meetings informed and prepared, and is comfortable in listening to others, has ambitious ideas, and that one of her great strengths is bringing together stakeholders to achieve a pleasant working environment for employees and attaining educational goals for students. Wright summed up his thoughts this way: Dr. Ramsey has integrity and a calm demeanor, which inspires trust in employees, students, and parents. The praise she has garnered in our district is unprecedented. Whether it is revisiting old practices, tweaking current policies, or exploring new ideas, her enthusiasm and willingness to look at situations honestly prove to be formulas for success. She is solution-oriented and is quick to identify the nature of the issue or problem and solve it. We could not be more excited about Ramsey and are very much looking forward to her becoming our next superintendent. To get a sense of her personality and to learn more about her, I encourage everyone to listen to a 9-minute podcast in which Ramsey was interviewed by searching the internet with these terms. Episode 16, Superintendent Angelica Ramsey, Pleasant Valley School District, California. $50 oil has some encouraged in the Permian, by Mella McEwen, MMCEWEN at MRT.com. Crude prices traded in a narrow range this week, boosted by hopes for more economic stimulus from the incoming Biden administration, but also weighed by concerns about oil demand amid continued lockdowns to battle the COVID-19 pandemic. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange fell about 2.5% Friday, the lowest in a week and the sharpest decline in more than 3 weeks, according to Bloomberg. The crude ended at $52.36, down $1.21 from Thursday, but just above $52.25 at Monday's close. Posted prices after reaching $50 this week ended at $48.84 per barrel. Natural gas on the New York MEX added 7 cents to close at 2.737 per MCF Friday. Summit Petroleum has been keeping 2021 hedge capacity open until prices reach the current levels. Dennis Johnson, Chief Executive Officer and Chairman, told the Reporter-Telegram by email, We are grateful Saudi Arabia brought the higher prices forward with their unilateral production cut. We have layered in hedges at $49.50 and some more this week at $51 for the second half of 2021. I like having some downward protection until the worldwide vaccination programs are more fully implemented and demand recovery is more imminent. Tommy Taylor, Director of Development at Fasken Oil and Ranch, told the Reporter Telegram by email that his company is encouraged to see oil prices in the $50 range at this time. It appears that markets are increasingly confident that fuel demand is going to return to pre-pandemic levels soon. Underinvestment in the oil and gas sector is also weighing on the supply side, along with the news that Saudi Arabia has committed to further reducing supply volumes in the short term. We are very hopeful that the COVID-19 pandemic case numbers will begin to decrease as the vaccines continue to be distributed and more American citizens can protect themselves from this terrible disease. We are all anxious for the pandemic to be over so that we can go back to living our lives in a normal way. Jason Moglen, president of the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers, commented to the Reporter Telegram by email, $50 plus oil is a welcome signal that the industry and our broader economy are on the road to recovery. In its January short-term energy outlook, the U.S. Energy Information Administration forecast raised its expectations for oil prices, West Texas Intermediate at $48 a barrel, and Brent, the international standard, at $53 a barrel. In its outlook, the agency commented the January STEO remains subject to heightened levels of uncertainty because responses to COVID-19 continue to evolve. Reduced economic activity and charges to consumer behavior in response to the COVID-19 pandemic caused energy demand and supply to decline in 2020. The ongoing pandemic and the success of vaccination programs will continue to affect energy use in the future. After falling 7.8% last year, the agency expects U.S. total energy consumption will rise by 2.5% this year and next year. The agency also estimates global consumption of petroleum and liquid fuels averaged 92 million barrels per day for all of 2020, down by 9 million from 2019. EIA expects global liquid fuels consumption will grow by 5.6 million barrels a day in 2021. According to agency estimates, U.S. crude oil production fell from the 2019 record level of 12.2 million barrels per day to 11.3. EIA expects that annual average production will fall 11%. 11 million barrels but before rising to 11.5 million in 2022. At the same time, the EIA forecasts crude oil production from the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries will average 27 million barrels a day in 2021, up from an estimated 25 million in 2020.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, January 16th, 2021. Opinion. Flat 93 election metaphor holds true on January 6th. President Donald Trump finally did what the foremost metaphor associated with his political rise would have suggested. He plowed his plane into the ground. That metaphor is Flat 93, courtesy of Michael Anton, author of a famous essay before the 2016 election about how Republicans had no option but to get on board with Trump. Charge the cockpit or you die, Anton wrote. The Flat 93 election became a signature statement of Trumpism and remains incredibly relevant today. Its mood perfectly captures the post-election period and especially what happened at the U.S. Capitol. Fevered, dark, and apocalyptic. Anton wrote, as if the end of the Republic were upon us, and there's nothing like a rabble storming a citadel of American democracy to buttress this view. Of course, it was the man Anton believed could be our savior who whipped up this crowd. The mob didn't charge the cockpit metaphorically, but charged the Capitol literally, in the grip of a more extreme, rough-hewn version of Anton's logic and narrative. Anton is obsessed with a coming democratic tyranny or coup. So, too, are Trump and his most fanatical supporters, who weren't content simply to write highfalutin essays about how to resist the coup or stop the steal. If the pen is mighty, only baseball bats and projectiles can really make Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi afraid. Make no mistake, a Flight 93 mentality led to the January 6th presidency, now defined not by any of the good it accomplished, but by a hideous act of extremism in its desperate, spittle-flecked final days. In Anton's defense, he never said he believed that Trump knew how to fly a plane. In the future, when hiring someone to pilot the most advanced jetliner on the planet, he might want to add that to the job description and check a couple of references. Anton wrote that only in a corrupt republic, in corrupt time, could a Trump rise. Rather than concluding that this spoke poorly of Trump, he made it into a kind of virtue. "Yes, Trump is worse than imperfect," he wrote. "So what?" So what, indeed. Trump was supposed to be a winner when other Republicans, Anton argued, were hopeless losers. In reality, Trump won a fluky victory in 2016 with just 46.1% of the vote. Predictably, he lost the House in 2018. He then lost his re-election bid and contributed to the loss of the GOP Senate majority with his outlandish claims of election fraud. In office, Trump didn't win saving America from the apocalypse-type victories, as one would have expected from Anton's hysterical advocacy. Instead, they were the achievements of a standard Republican with a populist bent, tax cuts with tariffs on top. Trump threw away his presidency in the end, though, largely because of the character flaws that Anton dismissed or valorized. In his essay, Anton attacked his conservative enemies as caring only about their careers and money, while throwing in with the rank egoist who fetishizes his wealth and status, who didn't care enough about his supporters or his own political cause to work harder in office or moderate his behavior, who led his most committed supporters into a box canyon of lies and conspiracy theories after the election, because he couldn't admit that he lost. What made Anton's essay so bracing was its undercurrent of nihilism, a sense that character and norms no longer matter, not when we are engaged in an existential struggle for power. Trump has acted in keeping with an exaggerated version of this ethic, throwing aside truth and the law in pursuit of a second term to which he is not entitled. We have seen that this path isn't suited to saving the republic, but to tearing it apart and embarrassing it before the world. It can't and shouldn't work, and produced an immediate backlash and second impeachment. This is not really fighting, it is giving up. Rich Lowry, King Features Syndicate. Opinion Extra. Voters should see how Trump led GOP astray. Republicans who want to move the party forward after impeachment will have to confront the election fraud myth that sparked the January 6th Capitol riot. That will require courage because Republican voters have been fed a steady diet of lies and untruths about the vote since Election Day. Tackling the issue head-on, however, will both show moderate Americans that Republicans love democracy and highlight to rank-and-file GOP voters how badly President Donald Trump led them astray. For months, The typical Republican has been steadily hearing that the election was stolen. Few can probably recite specific facts to support that claim, but they know that people they trust, from Trump to his lawyer Rudy Giuliani to conservative media personalities, say this happened. For many, liberals and Democrats are the only people they have heard say otherwise. Naturally, they believe the people they trust over the ones they don't. Combating this means Republican officials must take to the conservative media to aggressively push back. That, in turn, will mean confronting each of the voter fraud myths head-on, armed with clear and persuasive evidence. The facts are there to support them, but they need to be aware of what the Trump propaganda machine has been spewing to make the case. The fraud arguments fall roughly into three categories. The first is that mail-in ballots, regardless of whether they were solicited by the voter or sent unsolicited by election officials, were misused to cast fraudulent votes for Joe Biden. Specifically, it's alleged that many states did not rigorously match signatures on the ballot envelopes to those on a voter's registration card, thereby allowing votes cast by fraudsters to get into the mix. It's true that some states have lower rates of ballot rejection for mail ballots than they have in the past, but that could be due to a number of circumstances, the most important being that so many more people used mail ballots in 2020 than previously. In any event, even applying prior rejection rates to the total of mail ballots cast in 2020 would not have changed the result of the election. Biden's margin in virtually every swing state far exceeds the number of votes that theoretically could have been disqualified under this fraud myth's contention. The second pro-fraud argument is that election officials in selected cities stuffed the ballot box during election night counting. The only evidence given to try to back this allegation are the alleged absence of GOP vote monitors in some locations and the footage that supposedly shows an election worker in Fulton County, Georgia, finding a stack of ballots under a table once GOP monitors were gone. Neither allegation holds up under close scrutiny. None of the counts produced by the supposedly fraudulent vote counters in Democratic and usually majority black cities are inconsistent with those produced in prior elections. Moreover, precinct data from large cities around the country show the same trends as those in the cities labeled as fraudulent by Trump. This strongly suggests that the vote counts in the targeted cities were accurate, regardless of the presence of GOP monitors, unless one wants to believe that every single election authority in the country was in on the steal. The Fulton County footage is also easily explicable, as Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, a Republican, has argued, and Georgia law enforcement has found. Finally, the claim that Dominion voting machines switched votes from Trump to Biden is also laughably easy to dismiss. Dominion produces a number of machines, and the ones most commonly in use are ballot preparation machines and counting machines. Ballot preparation machines record a voter's choices and print the actual ballot. If the alleged switching occurred then, the voter could have spotted it and protested, which would lead to him or her getting a new ballot. Vote counting machines are checked after the election during the canvassing period, when randomly selected precincts are hand-counted to match the hand counts to the machine counts. Again, unless everyone, including the Republican Party canvassers, are in on the steal, machine count fraud would be caught. Indeed, an analysis of Michigan's county returns by the conservative election website RRH Elections found no difference between counties that used Dominion machines and those that did not. Republican officials who aggressively make this case will slowly but surely change Republican voters' minds. Once that happens, the people whose minds have changed will understand that they were duped by the man they trusted. Once burned, twice shy. These people would never fall for Trump's lies again. That turn of mind is essential to taking the party back from the brink and preparing it for future election victories. Henry Olson, special to the Washington Post. Dems once occupied capitals. Mark A. Thiessen, Washington Post Writers Group. Thousands of protesters rushed to the Capitol Wednesday night, forcing their way through doors, crawling through windows, and jamming corridors. That is how one newspaper described the storming of the Capitol. Not the one in Washington last week, but the state capitol in Madison, Wisconsin, a decade ago. Back then, thousands of pro-union activists, many bussed in from out of state, rampaged through the historic building in an effort to stop a vote on collective bargaining reform legislation. So when I saw the images of a pro-Trump mob rampaging through the U.S. Capitol last week, my first thought was, what is Scott Walker thinking right now? It's like I'm having a PTSD from a decade ago, the former Republican governor of Wisconsin texted me. Most conservatives have condemned the right-wing mob that assaulted the U.S. Capitol. But 10 years ago, Democrats embraced the left-wing mob that occupied the state capitol in Madison. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, D. California, praised the occupiers for an impressive show of democracy in action and tweeted as they assaulted the Capitol that she continued to stand in solidarity with the union activists. In other words, Democrats were for occupying capitals before they were against it. Walker and I co-wrote a book, Unintimidated, in which we describe the attack on the Capitol in Madison. Standing on the Capitol steps at dusk, Secretary of Administration Mike Hoopsch watched as an army of thousands formed on State Street and began marching toward him, we wrote. Soon they had descended on the building, banging on the doors and windows, chanting, "Let us in! Let us in!" The small contingent of Capitol Police was quickly overwhelmed. Protesters ripped the hinges off an antique oak door at the State Street entrance and streamed inside. Mike watched in disbelief as the window to Democratic Representative Corey Mason's office opened right in front of him and protesters began crawling into the building. Once inside, they began unlocking doors and bathroom windows until a sea of thousands had flooded the Capitol. The police retreated in the face of the horde, giving up the first floor, then the second. The protesters ran amok, chanting, "This is our house," and "This is what democracy looks like," we wrote. And they then began searching for the Republican senators who had dared to defy the will of the unions. As the crowd scoured the building, looking for the offending legislators, police sneaked them out through an underground tunnel to a government building across the street. But a Democratic representative posted on social media that the Republican senators were escaping through the tunnels. So when the senators came up into the lobby, the mob was there waiting for them. The tall windows that framed the lobby were plastered with people yelling and banging on the glass, we wrote. They were trapped. The senators hid under a stairwell, out of view, while the police ordered a city bus to pull up in front of the building. Officers then formed a human wall on the sidewalk, parting the sea of protesters and creating a pathway for the senators to reach the bus. Once the senators were on board, the mob on the street began punching the windows and shaking the vehicle. The police told the senators and staff inside to keep their heads down in case a window shattered. Thankfully, no one was killed, but during the course of the occupation, Walker received a steady stream of death threats against him and his wife, including one that promised to gut her like a deer, and one threatening to kill his sons. Police found dozens of .22 caliber bullets scattered across the Capitol grounds. The occupiers drew chalk outlines of fake dead bodies etched with Walker's name on the floor and carried signs that read, "Death to Tyrants. The only good Republican is a dead Republican," and one with picture of him in crosshairs with the words, "Don't retreat, reload." I asked Walker this week what lessons we might take from the two occupations. On the positive side, he said, the angry mobs did not deter elected officials from their responsibilities in either instance. The Wisconsin legislature approved Walker's bill in 2011, just as Congress reconvened to certify Joe Biden's victory last week. The good news is that our democracy has once again proved itself resilient against mob rule. The bad news is that some on the right now emulate the left-wing mob Nancy Pelosi celebrated and conservatives rightly condemned in Madison a decade ago. That will be among President Donald Trump's most shameful legacies.
Obituaries and death notices. Billy Work Steigen, Papaw Bill, 96 of Midland, passed away on January 12th. Graveside services will be held later this year in Fort Worth. The family requests that memorial donations be made to the favorite charity or church. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Dorothy Sexton passed away Monday, January 11th. She was 87 years old. A graveside memorial service will be held at Prairie Haven Memorial Park Cemetery in Hobbs. The event timing is pending and will be published later. Services are under the direction of Chapel and of Hope Funeral Home of Hobbs. Frank Salas Chavarria Jr., 60 of Midland, passed away on Wednesday, January 13th, surrounded by his family. Viewing will be on Sunday, January 17th from 3 to 9 p.m. with a rosary at 7 p.m. at Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral Mass will be held on Monday, January 18th at 10 a.m. at San Miguel Catholic Church in Midland. Helen Butts Stacy departed this life and went to be with her Lord and Savior on January 13th. Funeral service will be held at Life Point Baptist Church at 2 p.m. on January 16th in Harper, with burial to follow at Lawn Haven Memorial Gardens. Jane Trulock Majors was born September 13th, 1922 in Paris, Texas, and died recently in Midland. A funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Monday, January 18th at Nellie Pickle Welsh Funeral Home. Internment will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Joyce Marie Simpson, 85 of Amarillo, passed away on January 5th. Graveside services will be held Wednesday, January 20th at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland. Ellis Funeral Home has been entrusted with the arrangements. Lillian Money Riley passed away peacefully on January the 11th in Bandera, Texas, after a courageous fight with cancer. The family will welcome visitors at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home on Monday, January 18th from 5 to 7 p.m. to visit and share memories. Immediately following, please join us for dinner at Riley's to celebrate her life. Funeral services for Maria Inez Acevedo, age 92 of Midland, will be held Saturday, January 16th at First Baptist Church at 10 a.m. Burial will follow at Gaines County Cemetery. All services are under the direction of Boyer Funeral Home. Maria passed away at her home on Wednesday, January 13th. Royce Arthur Cassell of Midland passed away Sunday, January 10th at the age of 80. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Susan Baca Smith, 47, passed away at her home in Burleson in early January due to complications from glioblastoma brain cancer. If you wish to honor her, donations of time or money could be made to local Meals on Wheels program or animal rescue organizations. Daryl Dean Moore, 75, of Midland, passed away Wednesday, January 13th. Memorial services will be held at a later date. Fanny Jo Smith, 85, of Odessa, passed away on January 9th. Graveside services will be Monday, January 18th at 11 a.m. at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory. Felicitas Hinosa, 90, of Midland, passed away Thursday, January 14th. Rosary will be Sunday evening, January 17th at 7 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Chapel. Funeral Mass is set for Monday, January 18th at 2 p.m. at San Miguel Archangel Catholic Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Lisa Ann Zizel Crawford, 54, of Midland, passed away January 6th. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Arrangements are being made with Ellis Funeral Home in Midland.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, January 16th, 2020. Section A. MCH prepping for vaccines next week. Pre-register online or via phone for the Pfizer shot, by Federico Martinez. Medical Center Health System's pre-registration link for the COVID-19 vaccine is now accessible to the public at https://secure.echd.org/QDREGVAX/default.aspx. For those without internet access, MCH has created a COVID-19 vaccine hotline at 432-640-2220. The phone line will be answered Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. The hospital is expected to receive its first weekly shipment of 3,900 doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine Monday and begin administering shots within days, MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin said Thursday. We are excited to be able to roll out these vaccinations to the community, he said. We are asking for patience as we initially roll out this mass vaccine plan. We have been working for months with several entities, including the Odessa Incident Command, on developing an efficient rollout plan, but know we will inevitably face challenges along the way. Our goal is to get these out as quickly and smoothly as possible. As announced earlier this week, MCH is partnering with the City of Odessa's Incident Command to begin the mass rollout of the vaccine to the Permian Basin. Plans for the drive-through vaccination clinic are being finalized for Ratliff Stadium, with dates and times to be announced early next week. The pre-registration link is not for setting up an appointment or a specific date and time to receive the vaccine, MCH officials said. It is a pre-registration tool that will speed up the process of administering the vaccine. Community members that fall under the Phase 1B of the vaccination rollout are the first priority, but the pre-registration link is open to all. MCH has also created an email address specifically for questions regarding the COVID-19 vaccine. That email address is covidvaccine@echd.org. It will not be used for pre-registration, but only to answer the community's questions regarding the vaccine. It will be monitored Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Anyone interested in volunteering their time or make supply or food donations to the staff and volunteers working the clinics where vaccinations will be offered. Email volunteers@odessatx.gov. Needed donation items include water, Gatorade, grab-and-go snacks, lunches for volunteer teams, pens, stand-up heaters, hand warmer packets, and trash bags. MCH Friday reported 76 COVID patients, 22 in intensive care, and 16 on ventilators. IB students find new ways to give back, by Ruth Campbell. With community service being a part of Odessa High School's International Baccalaureate, IB, program, and COVID-19 still present in the community, students and teachers have had to find new ways of fulfilling the aspect of the curriculum. Lee Jordan, AP World History, International Baccalaureate History teacher and CAS coordinator, said his students have pursued a variety of projects, from pen pals across the world to giving goodie bags to children at High Sky Children's Ranch and making blankets for the Odessa Animal Shelter. Jordan said IB students take 6 or 7 extremely difficult courses, but it's the only program in the world that includes development of the person. He noted that the essays mentioned run 4,000 words. Then you've got TOK, which is a theory of knowledge class. But they also have the CAS, which is really designed to focus on the kid, help them grow, help them learn exactly what these girls are talking about, how to give back, how to be more than just somebody who knows a bunch of stuff out of a textbook, Jordan said. Jared Sandati Sr. said Sejal Yardaya, a fellow senior in the class, devised the Pen Pal Venture, which Sandati said started last year. Sandati has a pen pal from Thailand. They have learned the similarities and differences between what they are taught in Odessa and what his pen pal learns in Thailand. Sandati said they correspond via email. I have a pen pal from Thailand, and he was saying that over there, that the economy has been really affected, but also their way of life, and that they don't know what to believe, basically. So I'm like, the same thing here, Sandati said. He added that one of the major issues in Thailand is exploitation of immigrants. Despite COVID, they still use immigrant workers to do labor in the country. Sandati said he has another pen pal in Luxembourg, who said it's been a difficult time there, but she's adjusting and she can handle it. Yadaya said it's nice to see how much they have in common with their peers in far-off places. I think this program is cool because even though we're taught so many different things, it still brings us together because we all have the same extended essay. We have the same papers and subjects, so sharing those, that struggle and joy of being in the program is just a really cool thing that I'm glad that we could bring it to everybody in our class, Yadaya said. Akash Agirakula, Sr., said he was paired with a pen pal from the Bahamas. He said he's enjoyed emailing back and forth. We're talking about, like, the classes that she likes, and we had some classes in common that we both enjoy. I also want to become a doctor, which is kind of funny. She wants to become a doctor as well, Angirakula said. Adalis Lopez, 18, Melanie Sanchez, and Ariana Cabral, both 17, wrote letters to children at the High Sky Children's Ranch and visited them. They decided to make baskets and put toiletries and things that children liked in them. They received a thank you letter, which made them feel good about themselves. They visited before Christmas and got a tour. Leslie Lopez and Ashley Moreno, both 17, coordinated making blankets and distributing them to the Odessa Animal Shelter. They taught other people how to make blankets as well. Lopez said it made them feel really good to be able to do this. Both students said they feel the community service part of being in IB is very important. Lopez said, as young adults, they need to learn how to help the community and give back. I think it's a great opportunity for us, Moreno said. The fact that they give us the time to go out there and just expose us to the outside world. COVID-19 vaccines. Medical Center Hospital will receive its first weekly shipment of 3,900 doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine Monday. To register, visit tinyurl.com/YXMXYOXL. For community members who do not have internet access, MCH has created a COVID-19 vaccine hotline at 432-640-2220. This phone line will be answered from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Odessa Regional Medical Center on 6th Street is expecting COVID-19 vaccines soon. The vaccine is free of charge while supplies last. Please check on vaccine availability. For more information, call 432-582-8549 or visit tinyurl.com/Y3JQHZ89. Walgreens is currently delivering vaccinations to long-term care facilities and will have vaccines for the public sometime in 2021. For more updates or information, visit tinyurl.com/Y3LNWU83. HEB has requested more COVID-19 vaccine from the state of Texas. Once they have vaccine, eligible customers can sign up using the scheduler to receive a COVID-19 vaccine at no cost. To sign up, updates or information, visit vaccine.heb.com. The CVS stores will soon have the no-cost COVID-19 vaccine available. They will administer in a phased approach based on state guidelines when available to pharmacies. For updates or information, visit tinyurl.com/Y508QJE4. Incumbents file for ECISD board. Four incumbents have filed for the Ector County Independent School District Board of Trustees. The filing period started January 13th and runs to February 12th. Hours are 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. The election is May 1st. Those who have filed are Secretary Steve Brown, Trustee Nelson Minyard, President Delma Abalos, and Trustee Chris Stanley. Brown represents Position 5, Stanley, Position 4, Minyard, Position 7, and Abalos, Position 2. Stanley was appointed to finish the unexpired term of Doyle Woodall, who resigned in June after putting posts on Facebook that some might find offensive. Those interested can mail the applications to Cynthia McNabb, Post Office Box 3912, Odessa 79760-3912, or email to cynthia.mcnabb@ectorcountyisd.org or fax to 432-456-9878. People can come to the administration building physically to fill out an application at 802 North Sam Houston. More information may be found on the ECISD website. Positions 2, 4, 5, and 7 on the ECISD Board of Trustees are up for election in May. Three positions on the Odessa College Board of Trustees are up for election. On the OC Board, spots held by Vice President Gary Johnson, place 7, Secretary Larry Johnson, place 5, and J.E. Coach Presley are up for a vote. Those interested should file with the office of Ken Zartner, Vice President for Administrative Services at Odessa College. The office can be reached at 432 435-6701.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.